You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network. You are listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. If you have any thoughts, any questions, any comments, we'd love to hear it. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1905. That was the day a boiler explosion destroyed the R.B. Grover shoe factory in Brockton, Massachusetts. The boiler exploded as workers arrived for the day shift. 58 workers were killed and another 150 were injured. The boiler reportedly shot up through all three floors and the roof of the building. The floors collapsed and the walls caved in. Those who survived the initial explosion were fatally trapped by debris and machinery. Fires spread rapidly throughout the plant, ignited by broken gas lines and industrial solvents. The entire block, including nearby homes and businesses, were leveled to the ground. Many of the dead were never positively identified. The Leather Workers Union provided financial assistance. So did R.B. Grover, who was ruined financially by the disaster. Boiler inspectors concluded the explosion was caused by a manufacturing defect that was virtually impossible to detect. The courts held no one liable. By 1890, over 100,000 boilers providing steam heat were in use. Over 2,000 had exploded during the 1880s alone. The American Society of Mechanical Engineers had been in existence for some 25 years by the time the boiler exploded at Grover. They had released some guidelines, but it was clear that inspections were rare and standards were needed. The public outcry only grew in Massachusetts after another industrial boiler explosion occurred the next year. The state passed measures establishing rules of operation. By 1914, the American Society of Mechanical Engineers had successfully pushed back against manufacturers and railroad managers who opposed boiler regulations. They published the first edition of the National Boiler and Pressure Vessel Code. A national board of inspectors soon followed. Since then, regulations ensuring safe operation and maintenance have saved countless lives. And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. This week's lots going on. One of the big things, the Trump budget. Now, we've all heard the phrase, you know, a budget is a moral document. It's a list of priorities. It shows where your soul is. And you know what? This budget does, well, all of that. If you look at the list of priorities, because if you remember during the campaign, Donald Trump said, you know, we're not going to cut Social Security. We're not going to cut Medicare. We're not going to go after Medicaid. We're not going to do what those Republicans have wanted to do for decades. Not going to do it. And yet every budget that he's proposed has done just that, and also attempted to destroy more of our social safety net. What little is still left. This is a slash and burn budget. Now, understand, right from the start, this budget doesn't stand a snowball's chance of actually becoming law. But the thing that gets me is knowing that this doesn't stand a chance of becoming law, this is what they chose their priorities to be. 57% of the discretionary spending, they're moving into the Pentagon. So more military spending, less on, well, everything else. And some pretty drastic stuff, like $220 billion cut to the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. You know, SNAP, the food stamps. Literally taking food out of the mouths of children. That is their priority. And what gets me is while they're really taking food out of the mouths of children, they're still moving forward on, well, building their idiotic wall. Also, the TANF money, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, talking about a $21 billion cut to that as well. Also, $207 billion in cuts to student loan programs. You go down the list of just the insane stuff that they've proposed. You know, 9% cuts to, you know things like Section 8 housing, you know, Head Start. You go down the list. WIC, you know, literally, again, taking food out of the mouths of children. And massive cuts. You look at what they want to do to the EPA. More than a 31% cut to the EPA's budget. And that tells you where their priorities are. We don't want clean air. We don't need clean water. We want to make polluting great again. They proposed a 19% cut to the Department of Transportation, 18% cut to the Housing and Urban Development, 12% cut to agriculture, 12% cut to the Department of Health and Human Services, 12% cut to the Science Foundation, 12% cut to education. And it goes down from there until you get to, obviously, until you get to the Department of Homeland Security, which saw a 15% increase. And the thing that gets me, and this is one of those things that just infuriates me, is that there are folks who look at this and go, this is what we should do. This is a moral budget. I had someone make an argument to me because they believe that there are lazy and shiftless people out there who are living off of the government's dime, and that this is going to make them go out and get jobs. And I just kind of, as I internalized that comment, because I had it from a couple of listeners to our radio program, I couldn't help but think of this company, this healthcare service corporation, which administers some healthcare plans, Blue Cross and Blue Shield healthcare plans in a number of states for the ACA and other things. They paid no federal income tax in 2018. So they're one of the, if you listen to Mitt Romney in 2012, and the 47% of people who don't pay any federal taxes, this company is one of those 47%. This is one of the lazy and shiftless. They're paying nothing. And not only are they paying nothing, unlike the 47% of working people who don't make enough money to pay federal income tax, we gave them a massive $1.7 billion tax break, which helped jump their profit margin from a mere $1.3 billion in 2017 all the way up to $4.1 billion in 2018. That, my friends, is what's known as corporate welfare. And yet you don't hear people complaining about that. And I keep asking the question, $1.7 billion handout because of the tax scheme that the Republicans pushed through. How much health care could that have gotten people? If we use that $1.7 billion or the $4.1 billion in profit that they put in their pockets, how much of that could have been used for, granny's hip replacement, prescription drugs for virtually every senior in the country? How much health care? How much preventative care? How much could we have gotten in the way of making our society healthier as opposed to just going, here's a massive handout? And you talk about a list of priorities. You talk about the moral fiber of the document. You talk about values. And as I said from the beginning, Donald Trump said he was not going to cut Social Security, was not going to cut Medicare, was not going to cut Medicaid. In fact, his exact statement, June 15th, 2015, was Social Security, I'm not going to cut it at all. Save Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security without cuts. Have to do it, he said. Have to do it. And yet now he's talking about cutting $25 billion from Social Security, $241 billion from Medicaid, and $845 billion from Medicare. And over the next decade, you look at the cuts to Social Security that they want to go after and the cuts that they want to go after to Medicare and Medicaid to starve and destroy the programs. And you go, why would anyone vote for this party anymore? And it's curious to me, and I struggle with it quite often, because I look at the priorities that they've laid out in this budget, and they're not the priorities that most working people in this country have. We've given more to the very wealthy. We've given more to big defense contractors. We've given more to the already well-to-do, and we're kicking those at the bottom again. As if income inequality in this country isn't bad enough, which one poll I saw listed us 93rd in the world in income inequality, whereas we used to lead the world in standard of living. I look at that and I keep asking, when do we wake up? And I asked my friends who are Trump supporters, is this the budget you want? These massive cuts to virtually every program that benefits we, the working people of this country. You talk about picking winners and losers. We know who the winners are. Question is, do we know that we're the losers? Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me what you think. I know what I think. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So, you know, I keep going back. I can't get this budget out of my mind. And again, as I said in the last segment, there's no way that this passes. There's no way that this becomes law. And thank goodness for the Democrats in the House who will stop all of the horrible that is coming, that could come if this passes. But this, again, back to the list of priorities, back to the list of the family values crowd. Well, their values. And here to share some thoughts on, well, the family values crowd's values, I've asked our friend Rebecca Vallis to come talk with us. She's the vice president of the Poverty to Prosperity program there at the Center for American Progress. Rebecca, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much, Rick. Always a pleasure.
So, you know, what jumps out at the page at me right at the very beginning is the Family Values Party, you know, literally taking food out of the mouths of children by cutting TANF and SNAP.
No, you're exactly right. And, you know, you're zeroing in on two of the most painful and really cruelest and mean-spirited cuts in this entire budget. But that's the through line of this entire budget, is taking away the basics like food and housing and healthcare, things that people literally need to survive. And doing that from as many people as possible, all to pay for those tax cuts that you were just referencing, right? It's just been months since we actually watched $2 trillion in tax cuts for the wealthiest people in this country, as well as incredibly wealthy corporations, take effect. And we actually just got new numbers out of Treasury last week that told us that the deficit in this country has now gone up by 77% just in fiscal year 2018. And so that's what Trump is staring in the face, is a massively ballooned deficit thanks to his enrichment of his donor class and of wealthy corporations in this country. But what he's doing yet again is turning around and telling America's workers and working families that we're the people who need to pay for those millionaire and billionaire and corporate tax cuts. And what he wants to do is, just as you said, to target the people who are least able to afford giving up the funds that already aren't enough to put food on the table and keep a roof over their heads. You mentioned the TANF cuts. I want to go there just for a second, just to underscore how incredibly mean-spirited this is. TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, that's a program that is so underfunded at this point that it only helps fewer than one in four poor families with children in this country. And if you're lucky enough to be one of those families, you're not even going to get brought up to half of the federal poverty line with those benefits. That's a program that Trump is looking at and saying, I know there's probably room to squeeze there. Let's take some of that and use it to backfill the deficit that we've now blown up with millionaire tax cuts. That's the kind of budget that this is.
Oh, it's insane to me. And, you know, I'm not naive. I know that any budget that's going to come out from the Trump administration, any budget that's going to come from a Republican president, is going to be bad. But again, I go back to, you know, Trump said on the campaign trail, we're not going to cut Social Security. We're not going to cut Medicare. We're not going to cut Medicaid. You expect all of the other stuff. But to see the incredibly large cuts that they proposed in this, and the thing that gets me is they know it doesn't stand a snowball's chance of passing, and yet they still said, this is our priority, these are our values, this is where we stand. And, you know, I'm still struggling with working class people looking at this and going, well, okay, I just don't get how you vote for these people.
Yeah, and Rick, I'm really glad actually that you just brought up the point that you did, right? Because in addition to being a whole slew of false promises all exposed, that's what these budgets are every time Trump puts them out, right? So just like you said, promise never to cut Social Security, promise never to cut Medicare, promise never to cut Medicaid, and yet he hits all three of those programs in a huge way in this budget. Medicare is a new one actually for him to be cutting. This is a new addition to his hit list. Social Security, he actually targets specifically people with disabilities, because how could you make cutting Social Security even crueler? Well, you could funnel all of those cuts toward disabled beneficiaries, and that's what this budget would do yet again. His Medicaid cuts are some of the cruelest things in this budget. He's doubling down on the policy that we're already watching play out in the states, like in Arkansas, where he's now encouraging states to take away health insurance through Medicaid from people who are struggling to find steady work and folks who are out of work. That's already been happening in Arkansas, which was one of the first states to take Trump up on that offer. I've actually talked with you about this on your show before, Rick. So as you know well, more than 17,000 people in Arkansas have already lost Medicaid because of that so-called work requirement that we really know is about taking health insurance away from people who can't find work. He doubles down on that in this budget and actually says, hey, why not make that a national policy? Why not have all the states do something like that? We would watch millions of people lose health insurance if that policy were to take effect. But one of the points that I really want to underscore that you just made, Rick, is a lot of people look at these presidential budgets and they say, oh, these are dead on arrival. Why should we pay attention to this? This is never going to become law. And there are a few really good reasons for why people should be paying attention to this budget proposal, just like the past proposals from this administration. Reason number one is because it's the clearest ever statement that we get from this president of his priorities. It's the agenda he wants to see enacted. Even though he doesn't have a Congress right now who's going to do that, thanks to those House Dems, these are the things he wants to be law. And so that's really important as the American people try to take a look at this administration, at this president, and say, is this the guy I voted for? And if you didn't vote for him, right, is this the guy I'm glad I didn't vote for? Another reason why this budget is incredibly important is because it's another reminder of the things that Trump is actually trying to do by fiat when he's not able to get them done legislatively. So people will remember who watch your show and listen to your show, Rick, that Trump tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act. He tried to decimate Medicaid. He wasn't able to do either of those things through legislation because the American people stood up loudly and clearly and said, we don't want to see that happen. And we did see a rejection of that agenda in Congress. However, Trump has now spent the last year plus doing everything he can to try to sabotage the Affordable Care Act, try to sabotage Medicaid. I just mentioned that policy working its way through the states, like in Arkansas. That is Trump with his new playbook trying to do whatever it is he wants on his cruel cuts agenda by fiat when he doesn't get his way through Congress. And so there's actually a lot in this budget that people do need to be paying attention to that he's trying to do as we speak. And I'm actually talking here specifically about the proposed cuts he wants to make happen to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which you just mentioned, Rick. That's the program formerly known as food stamps. Trump is literally, as we speak, trying to take food stamps away from upwards of 750,000 unemployed and underemployed workers. That's the kind of cut that we see in this budget that he's not waiting around for Congress to try to get done, because he actually watched them fail to do it in the Farm Bill when they, on a bipartisan basis, rejected that exact type of cut. So those are a few reasons why people really would ignore this budget at their peril if they just call it DOA.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this, again, you go back to the whole priorities thing, but those cuts, you know, as you lay them out, I keep thinking of my conservative friends who love to remind me that we're a Christian nation. And I seem to, you know, I go back to my, you know, my childhood and all the things that I learned growing up about, you know, taking care of the poor and feeding the hungry and, you know, clothing the naked and giving shelter to the homeless and all of those things that I grew up believing that quote unquote Christians believed in. And I see this budget and I really struggle with it.
Yeah, I really appreciate you putting it in those terms because, you know, when I say that this really is a conversation about priorities, some people often call budgets moral documents, and they really are, because economic policy is at its core a statement of what it is that you believe people deserve. And what this budget is a rejection of the idea that all humans deserve basic living standards, the idea that food is a right or that housing is a right. What it is instead is just one more piece of evidence that Trump is out to try to further enrich his wealthy millionaire friends instead of the vast majority of people in this country, many of whom are struggling to make ends meet. And I phrase it in that way, Rick, because, you know, as you were describing and sort of quoting scripture there, right, about the most vulnerable and the least among us and the poor, a lot of people might hear that and think, oh, well, you know, that's just people who live under the federal poverty line, or, oh, that's just some small slice of Americans who are really hard up. But when you actually look at the numbers, you find that about half of households, almost half of households in this country, are struggling to afford totally basic necessities like food, like housing, like healthcare, like childcare. 43% of households in this country are struggling to afford those kinds of basics. And when you add that to the fact that we know that 4 in 10 Americans don't even have $400 in the bank and would need to borrow money if they got hit with an unexpected expense of that amount, I mean, we're talking about a country where a huge swath of our populace are living paycheck to paycheck and don't have much to protect them, as we saw from the shutdown, for example, if they end up falling on hard times even briefly. And so that's really a hell of a reminder of just how tone deaf and out of touch this administration is if it thinks that what it should be doing is giving yet another tax cut to yet another rich person with 3 yachts so that they can get a 4th yacht. And that's, make no mistake, what this budget calls for by actually enshrining a lot of those tax cuts made law by the tax law in 2017, 2018, and actually making them permanent where they're set to expire. That's the kind of choices and priorities that this budget and this administration are putting ahead of, say, people who are struggling to put food on the table for their kids. Yeah. And I'll give you one side-by-side comparison that really drives that point home. The tax cuts that Trump just gave to the richest 1% of people in this country cost more than the entire food stamp program. I'll let that sink in. And now, of course, Trump is turning around and saying, can't afford this food stamp program because it's part of what he considers to be bloat and wasteful spending that's driving up the deficit. Well, you were perfectly comfortable spending that amount of money when it was on your rich friends, just not when it's to help 39 million Americans eat. That's what this budget makes very clear is in Trump's mind.
Yeah, they love welfare as long as it's for their rich buddies. But when it's something to help the poor, that just makes them lazier. And I've heard that frame a lot, and I'm sure you have as well, in the work that you do, that, you know, we need people to, you know, need to be a little hungry so they'll work harder. That is probably one of the most idiotic things that people say to me, because especially when you're talking about education and kids going to school, because I'm a big proponent of school breakfast programs, school lunch programs. In fact, when I was a kid growing up, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. The public school in the summertime had a hot lunch every day. And I remember, you know, lining up with other kids. And it was, for a lot of those kids, the only hot meal they had every day. And thanks to Ronald Reagan, who came in, wiped that all out. But there's this view that, you know, we're going to make those, they'll work a little harder if they're hungry, which is just total bunk.
No, you're hitting the nail on the head, Rick, and you know, it actually brings to mind the proposal that Newt Gingrich had, right, that he was actually running on when he was running for president. He wanted kids in schools to have to work as janitors for their free lunch, because we need to teach people early on that there's no such thing as a free lunch. I mean, this is some of the stuff that's like in these conservative minds when they're coming up with ideas to take basics away, like food, from people who are struggling. But at its core, making someone hungrier isn't going to help them find work any faster. That might sound like common sense to your listeners and to your viewers. It's also borne out by the research, which tells us that when you actually make sure someone has access to adequate nutrition and to safe and stable housing and hey, to health insurance, if we're getting luxurious, those people then are much better able to work. They have higher earnings. They're better able to work more hours. I mean, if you actually care about people being able to thrive in the workplace and to be part of the workforce in this country, what we should be doing is making sure that we have a strong set of basic living standards and protections for when people are struggling in the labor market. And so Trump, frankly, has it backwards. He's trying to punish joblessness with hunger, when what we should be doing is making sure people have the foundation that they need so that they can then be part of our workforce.
No, absolutely.
One of the ways I like to think about this, Rick, is that for someone to be in favor of the idea of so-called work requirements, that sort of hammock of dependency mindset that you were just describing, you have to believe three myths about poverty. First, you have to believe that, quote, the poor are some stagnant group of people who just don't want to work. We know that that's not true at all, based on what we've been talking about this entire conversation and how many people are struggling with low wages that are poverty wages. The second myth is that anyone who wants a well-paying job can just snap their fingers and make it appear. We know that's not the case, and your listeners and viewers know that better than a lot of people. And third, that having a job is all it takes not to be poor. And as long as we have a federal minimum wage in this country that isn't enough to keep people out of poverty, then I think we can be pretty clear that all of those things are myths on which a terrible public policy, that is work requirements, is premised.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, one of the things that I had hoped, and I said when Barack Obama was elected president, I said the only thing I want from him, the only thing I hope, is that he's able to return reward to work. Because I agreed with Ronald Reagan. I think the best anti-poverty program is a jobs program. I would amend that to say a union jobs program, a union job that comes with livable wages, good health care benefits, and some bit of retirement security. The sad reality is there aren't enough of those jobs out there to go around. That's where we should be putting our focus.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And if Trump were really serious about shrinking the number of people in this country who need to turn to food assistance because their wages aren't enough or because they're having trouble finding good jobs, what he would be doing is supporting raising the minimum wage. And in fact, research out of the Center for American Progress, where I work, has found that if you raise the minimum wage to $12, not even to the $15 that we all know it needs to be at, but this is analysis that is being updated as we speak. But if you raise it even just to $12 an hour, what you do is you save $53 billion in SNAP, the food stamp program. And that's because, shocking, fewer people will be hungry, more people will have enough in earnings to be able to afford food. Yep. And so you'll have fewer people needing to turn to assistance to put food on the table. That $53 billion, by the way, that we could save in SNAP if we were to raise the minimum wage even just to $12, and which we know would be a lot more if we got it to 15, that's more than four times the amount that Trump is trying to cut from SNAP by this rulemaking that we were talking about before, where he's trying to take it away from 750,000 people by fiat. So just like wrap your head around the inanity of trying instead to make people hungrier as the source of savings that we know is actually just going to end up resulting in all kinds of spillover costs, because people are going to be sick and have other needs and become homeless, and it doesn't stop with just taking away their food.
No, you're absolutely right. Now, as someone who has used food stamps in the past when I was a kid, you know, as I said, growing up in the projects, you know, my mother was on and off welfare a couple of times because of the 70s were not friendly to single mothers. Always the last hired and the first out the door. So we were on welfare time, and I remember at the time the humiliation that came along with it, and I completely understand it. And I've always been someone who says we shouldn't even have to have food stamp programs. I believe we should have jobs programs. And if the private sector can't or won't create enough good paying jobs, the public sector has that responsibility. So I would much rather see a jobs program so people can have the dignity and respect that comes with being able to make your way. But if we're in the situation we're in now, you know, the least we can do in the wealthiest country in the world, the wealthiest country in the history of civilization, is to make sure people can get fed at the end of the day. It just seems basic and sane to me. Last question I've got for you, it's on the Medicaid cuts. This one seems rather cruel to me as well, because I know a lot of my friends seem to believe that Medicaid only pays for the poor. You know, it's those lazy and shiftless people again. But understand, those lazy and shiftless people are generally seniors in nursing homes. And there was a story, and maybe you remember it back, you know, I think it was last year, where Louisiana was going to, I guess, running out of money. And they were going to send out letters to people in nursing homes saying, sorry, we're out of money. Start looking for somewhere else to live. It's crazy to me.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And you know, I think frankly, actually in the Medicaid context, that's been, you know, one of the areas where people increasingly have started to realize how much that's a program for us as opposed to some them. I mean, Medicaid at this point is in more than 75 million Americans who in some form turn to that program. It's actually outpaced Medicare now in how many people's lives are touched by that program. It's just like you said, it's people in nursing homes, it's families who are struggling to make ends meet and low-income children, a lot of workers who don't have health insurance through their jobs and are paid low wages. Medicaid is also a major, major support for people with disabilities, not just for their health insurance, but it's also the nation's largest provider of long-term services and supports. And that's a set of supports that enable millions of people with disabilities to live independently and in their homes and in their communities instead of in cost and often isolating institutions, particularly for working age folks. Medicaid is also a work program, particularly for people with disabilities, many of whom would not be able to work outside the home if they didn't have those long-term services and supports that allow them to be in the workforce. So in a lot of ways, taking Medicaid away from people by the droves, which is what this budget would do, is not just cruel, it's not just heartless, it's not just a really, really bad idea for a lot of public policy reasons. It's also actually anti-work because it will make people less well able, less healthy to thrive in their jobs. And specifically in the case of people with disabilities, it will push people with disabilities out of the workforce and onto the sidelines by the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, if these kinds of cuts take effect. So can't really say on the one hand that this budget and this administration is pro-work, and on the other hand, be touting an agenda that's the exact opposite of that in more ways than we've enumerated even in this conversation.
Yeah, you're right. But, you know, hey, it does, while we're taking, you know, food out of the mouths of children, we're looking to kick granny to the curb and punish those poor people, at least we'll get a wall out of it.
Oh God! Don't get me started on the wall, Rick. Yeah, and it which is, you know, perhaps the right place to end, right? Because honestly, the only thing I think that Trump has learned from the past two budget releases his administration has done that have been raked over the coals was how to hide his cuts just a little bit better, right? He didn't learn that maybe he should listen to the American people or maybe start to think about what people are actually asking for. You know, spoiler. When you ask people what they think about Medicaid and SNAP and other programs, the answer is not to see them cut. 80% of Americans oppose cuts to Medicaid. 2/3 of Americans oppose cuts to nutrition assistance. But clearly Trump is not exactly listening to those kinds of cautions or feelings or preferences. He, you know, I guess is just getting the information he wants from Fox News and letting that color his understanding of what this country is asking for. But what he did learn from those past two deeply unsuccessful successful budget releases because of how unpopular the budgets were and how scathed they were in the media, was to release it in two parts so that it makes it harder for us policy wonks to even really see what they're trying to do and how these numbers add up. And so there's actually yet another budget release coming out next week. Get excited, Rick. And that's going to be the one where we have lots more in the way of details telling us exactly how he's looking to cut these programs and what the risks are.
And when they do, I'd love to have you back on to talk about that and share some of what's going on. Rebecca, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Sounds great. Thanks so much, Rick. Always a pleasure.
Fantastic. Our good friend, Rebecca Vallis, she's the vice president there of the Poverty to Prosperity program there at the Center for American Progress. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Is this the morality of the country? Is this where we're going? Is this the kind of budget you'd want to see passed? I'd love to hear it. Quick break. You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network. You are listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. If you have any thoughts, any questions, any comments, we'd love to hear it. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1905. That was the day a boiler explosion destroyed the R.B. Grover Shoe Factory in Brockton, Massachusetts. The boiler exploded as workers arrived for the day shift. 58 workers were killed, and another 150 were injured. The boiler reportedly shot up through all three floors and the roof of the building. The floors collapsed and the walls caved in. Those who survived the initial explosion were fatally trapped by debris and machinery. Fires spread rapidly throughout the plant, ignited by broken gas lines and industrial solvents. The entire block, including nearby homes and businesses, were leveled to the ground. Many of the dead were never positively identified. The Leather Workers Union provided financial assistance. So did R.B. Grover, who was ruined financially by the disaster. Boiler inspectors concluded the explosion was caused by a manufacturing defect that was virtually impossible to detect. The courts held no one liable. By 1890, over 100,000 boilers providing steam heat were in use. Over 2,000 had exploded during the 1880s alone. The American Society of Mechanical Engineers had been in existence for some 25 years by the time the boiler exploded at Grover. They had released some guidelines, but it was clear that inspections were rare and standards were needed. The public outcry only grew in Massachusetts after another industrial boiler explosion occurred the next year. The state passed measures establishing rules of operation. By 1914, the American Society of Mechanical Engineers had successfully pushed back against manufacturers and railroad managers who opposed boiler regulations. They published the first edition of the National Boiler and Pressure Vessel Code. A national board of inspectors soon followed. Since then, regulations ensuring safe operation and maintenance have saved countless lives. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So this past week during our radio program, one of the things I talked a little bit about was the massive trade deficit that we have, not just with China, but the rest of the world. In fact, the numbers for 2018, eye-popping. You're talking about $891 billion trade deficit with the rest of the world, $419 billion with China alone. And as I've said on this program a number of times, while I'm not a supporter of Donald Trump, I think the blind squirrel found a nut, and I'm hoping that he succeeds on negotiations with China. And here to share some thoughts on what's going on with China, what's going on with, well, with the trade negotiations, if they're positive, negative. I've asked Roy Hausman to come talk with us. He's the Associate Legislative Director with the United Steelworkers. Roy, thanks for taking time for us.
No, absolutely. Glad to be here. Thanks, Rick.
So as I've said, I'm not a Trump supporter, but I am a supporter of tariffs. I am a supporter of defending our industries, of stopping currency manipulation, of stopping dumping, of stopping, you know, the predatory practices that we see, especially with China. I'm looking at Donald Trump and I'm going, I hope he's the guy. What are your thoughts thus far?
So, you know, I think you're exactly right. We've run into a situation where Trump for a long time has had a very consistent message on trade. And for the steel workers, we've had a very consistent message on trade and how trade deficits have impacted our members and how this outsourcing displacement of major manufacturing in this country through bad trade policy has caused a significant shift in how we approach international trade, and these deficits are just a prime example of it. These $800 billion trade deficits, they end up causing a massive shift of gross domestic product that could be here in the U.S. of American workers producing those products and manufacturing to the globe. And instead, we're just bringing in these products, and workers here are having to compete for not the same jobs, but these lower tier service sector jobs that just don't have the same bargaining power and same capability as manufacturing.
No, and in fact, why manufacturing is so important. There's a statistic running around. I think everyone's seen it. Since 2000, some 60,000 factories that used to employ 500 people or more have closed since 2000. You think about it, that's 3 million plus jobs that were good paying, most of them union jobs with living wages, with healthcare benefits that were superior, with retirement security, with job security, and they're just vanished. It's not that we don't know where they are, but they're gone. They're not here anymore. And we're losing our manufacturing capacity and, that prosperous working class that we once had.
It's exactly right. I'll give you a prime example. I've helped fill out trade adjustment assistance petitions for over 10,000 workers now. And a great example here is in Flagstaff, Arizona, where there was a tissue plant where they actually made the rolls of paper for facilities across the country, but primarily supplied a box plant or, the next line of that manufacturing production, where they actually produced, they went and made the tissue from big rolls to smaller rolls, then distributed across the country. And the major mill closed, moved a lot of that production to Mexico. And then 2 years later now, the box plant, or the converting facility is what we call them here, is now in the process of shutting down. And so you just see this hemorrhaging of manufacturing positions across the country, and you just see how each product line, as it goes down through the supply chain, when it starts at base commodities like basic items like steel and basic components like paper, it goes up the supply chain where now the production is getting shifted into larger and more complex components. The example at Lordstown is a great example, is a prime example of this. So it used to be that just steering wheels and small components were made in Mexico. And now, like, the major auto companies are looking at having all of their small car production made overseas and not in the United States.
Yeah, and you brought up steel a second ago, and I remember when Trump said he was going to put tariffs on the steel industry, and I was saying, look, it's something I've been saying needed to be done for the last decade plus, and I cheered it. I said, let's do that, especially now. All of the people who at one point had agreed with me are like, no, the sky will fall, prices will go through the roof, and a can of soup will be $30, and all of this hair on fire stuff, and yet we haven't seen that. What we have seen is the steel industry doing pretty well in this country.
That's correct. I mean, we have produced over 5 million more tons of domestic steel this last year than we have than the year before. I mean, that's more American steel being sold in the U.S. to U.S. producers, who are then turning it into the products that we make all across the country today. And then you look at, all these threats of, lost manufacturing jobs. And while we are still in a major deficit of manufacturing jobs compared to 2000, in the last year plus, we've had a growth of 285,000 manufacturing jobs. So while there's a lot of screaming and crying about the sky falling down, we're just not seeing that in the manufacturing sector. Now, could things always be improved? Absolutely. But for the members, our members at Granite City, Illinois, and the workers at Fairfield, Alabama, who just heard that their electric arc furnace is going to be constructed by U.S. Steel, I mean, those are real jobs that our members are, and real production that's going to allow our country to compete globally. And right now those tariffs are preventing an oversupply of overcapacity steel from China and other countries from entering into the U.S. and flooding out and taking away good domestic manufacturing jobs.
No, I'm with you. And it's about time we stood up and defended ourselves. And this is, again, as I was saying during the 2016 election, Trump has stolen the union message, because this is what the labor movement had been saying for at least a decade on the trade policy. We need to defend our border. We need to stop currency manipulation. We need to stop, patent theft. We need to stop, all the things that have caused massive job loss in this country. And also, we need to wake up CEOs who were going, hey, there's cheap labor over there. Because as I've said a number of times, cheap labor to a CEO is like heroin. They just can't avoid it. They got to, what, cheap labor? And they're there. Yeah. Yet what they've done is they've given their industries away. And that's the thing that really just kind of freaks me out. How it is the smart people are so dumb.
Oh, it's just for us, it's very clear for us is that we have, our members work at global brands that, at brands that are globally recognized across the world. Goodyear Tire, ArcelorMittal, like largest steel company in the world. And, our members are there producing the products and producing high quality products. But we know that unless we improve trade and improve how we do trade so that we can help raise workers' wages in Mexico so that they're on more of an equal footing for us, how can U.S. workers compete against workers who are making $1.88 an hour? And how can those workers making $1.88 an hour in Mexico and other places afford to buy a car, to afford to buy the basic things that our members in the U.S. currently make? And so this is where we have to engage, and we have to say, you've done one thing right here in the fact that we've raised the alarm bells on how bad globalization and the Trump administration has maybe raised some tariffs on some key products that's helped regrowing some manufacturing here in the U.S. But that's just the first step in the process. And this is where labor and working people have to challenge the administration and challenge our elected officials to say, how are you going to do this better going forward? We've seen what 25 years of NAFTA has done to our U.S. manufacturing base and what PNTR, permanent normal trade relations with China has done. How are we going to make sure that not only the Trump administration, but future administrations prevent this sort of job loss? And that's what we are engaging in now. So while the administration, as you've pointed out very quickly, has found a nut, it's us to make sure that that nut grows into the tree of the future.
No, that's a perfect analogy. And, at the end of this is, my thought is this is where you jab the stake in the heart of neoliberalism. Stop with the free trade regime. Stop with the tax cuts for the very wealthy. Trickle down. Sorry, never was going to work. Has never worked. Will never work. Let's stop. Free trade, never going to work. I'm in favor of trade. But not this kind of we're buying stuff that we used to make here. And the Chinese are using the money that we're buying stuff from them with to buy us. This ain't working.
No, absolutely. We've got to change the process of how we do this. And we've got to show that globalization cannot be on the back of working people.
So legislatively, you're in D.C., you see this stuff going on. Outside of the rhetoric that we're seeing from Trump in the news, is there anything, coming behind this? Because, immediately I saw Republicans and some Democrats, saying, no, we got to stop these tariffs. We got to pass laws that won't let do this. What are you seeing legislatively? Because my fear is that, just because Trump's doing it, and I hate the fact that he's the guy who's doing it, my fear is that just because he's doing it, people are going to be against it. And we're going to end up in a position, worse off than where we are even now. And I think we're in a pretty bad spot right now.
No, I mean, you're hitting the nail right on the head here. This is an item where if we aren't engaged in making sure that members of Congress know how working people feel about trade, then they're going to move forward on positions in the new renegotiated NAFTA or pushing forward to eliminate some of these tariffs. And when we need to say, look, tariffs are a mechanism to, stop a problem that from continuing to stem that outflow. But we need to make sure that the administration and Congress say, we're going to enter trade differently. We're going to make sure that when we enter trade with these other countries, that it's in a fair and reciprocal manner. And it's so simple. And if we aren't careful, some members on a lot of the free traders are going to really push that forward. And the majority of those free traders are not in the Democratic Party. They're in the Republican Party. And this is where we have to kind of find that ideology and break down barriers between Republican and Democrat and say, No, the first most important piece of my life is my job that feeds my family and my kids, and I want that job to be secure.
Yeah, I find it curious that the party that ran on America First is still pushing the ideology of this. And I hate to call it free trade because it's really not. I mean, the game was rigged from the beginning because you've got a country who literally they want to dominate the world. And if you look at their China 2025 plan, they've got a plan to take over the world.
Yes. I mean, this is where we need to put a line in the sand of, like, if we want, you know, free and enterprise and, like, in, you know, this is what I say over and over again with our steel industry. These are private companies that are owned, you know, domestically and internationally, but they're private companies. And if you are a believer in this, like, in capitalism and this ability to, like, have a free market, then you got to be able to stand up to a country that doesn't provide by the same rules. And this is where we have to make that decision and does not allow its workers the freedom to associate in independent unions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm with you. And, you know, I'm still waiting for Donald Trump to declare China a currency manipulator. Because if you remember on the campaign trail, day one, he was going to do it. I'm still waiting for day one to come around. Maybe it hasn't happened yet. Maybe day one isn't here. But I seem to remember day one, we're going to label them a currency manipulator. Because the other argument that I get, and maybe, Roy, you can explain to me a little bit better, because what I get from people as well, you know, the tariffs aren't going to be effective because, well, if you raise 25% tariffs, they're just going to devalue their currency another 25%. Anything in that argument that you find factual?
I mean, of course, this is a concern that they're going to devalue their currency, but that rapid currency devaluation would just immediately marks up and proves the point that currency manipulation. So for a lot of these people who are worried about it, I mean, it shows that we can then take policy actions where, you know, the United States Senate has passed, bill saying, you know, filibuster proof bill saying that currency manipulation needs to be addressed in trade, you know, in trade investigations and others. We have that ability to do this if we engage Congress on it, and we also hold the administration accountable. And for us, it's like, you can see how the tariffs are already holding back by the, and increasing domestic production. And we've seen it time and time again since we've been participants with anti-dumping and countervailing duty, your regular trade cases. USW has been participant in over 90 of them. And, you know, when we're a participant in over 90 of these trade cases, we do it because we're seeing our members' jobs get shipped overseas from manufacturing, you know, from these, from state. With state-owned enterprises and with state subsidies and other items that are provided that the U.S. doesn't provide to its manufacturers, because we're trying to abide by the rules that we agree to under the WTO, and so many countries don't do that.
No, you're right. So
we have to take a firm stand. And the tariff policy, it's, you know, I find it fascinating, you know, roughly $8 billion in steel and aluminum tariffs are a concern for everyone and people freaking out about consumer prices. But yet the Trump tax cuts cut the corporate tax rate by almost 15%. I mean, how are, you know, the lost revenue from that alone is significantly higher than the revenue lost, the revenue gained from, and you don't see corporations cutting their prices for their imports anytime soon from the tax cuts, or let alone their domestic products.
Well, you're spot on there. And you also didn't see people getting the bonuses that they made such a big deal out of last year. And you're so spot on because, you know, we're trained like Pavlovian dogs to think about anything that restricts business is bad. It's horrible. You know, unions or your tariffs or regulations, all bad. But tax cuts for big corporations, oh, that's good. It'll eventually come trickling down on me.
And this is what's crazy to me is that, you know, I read recently the administration's tariff policies have really only raised tariff revenue coming into the U.S. government by 1.4%. I mean, that's, you know, 1.4% additional tax revenue coming in while they gave out, you know, massive tax cuts under the tax cut regime that the Republicans passed 2 years ago. And it's obscene that we continue to have, like, that so many big business interests will just throw, you know, the tariffs in front of consumers when they're reaping massive profits right now.
Last question I've got for you, because again, this is one of those issues that, you know, I know when Barack Obama became president, the Republicans came out and said, I hope he fails. You had, you know, McConnell saying we're going to make him a one-term president. You had Rush Limbaugh saying he hopes he fails, all that. I'm not going to say I want Trump to fail, because if he fails, we all fail. I don't want him to fail on this. So what do you hope he's able to do? What are you expecting in the coming days, and what do you think will help? If he's able to accomplish it, if he's able to do something on this, what does that look like?
So here's what I find most important here is that this is where there's a transition right now. The administration has negotiated a deal and they've really put forward a lot of effort. And, you know, labor and has been really engaged in that. But now the administration is getting close to that point where they're going to try and hand it over to Congress. And this is where Democrats and Republicans need to be able to say that, is this deal good enough for them? Is this deal good enough for working people? And so, you know, particularly with the renegotiated NAFTA, there's issues related to medicine prices, to labor rights, and environmental protections between the three countries that need to still be addressed. And Congress is where that action takes place. And so this is where, you know, you as a constituent or someone, one of your listeners, thinking about who they call, how do they make sure that they let someone know? This is where a member of Congress is going to be voting very quickly on a renegotiated deal. And the question is are they going to actually have these enforceable labor standards? Are we going to ensure that our medicine and prescription drug prices are not only contained, but we do things like save billions of dollars by reducing the data exclusivity on the largest growing level of biologic medicines. This is a major two-thirds of all Medicare Part B prescription drugs are biologics. And the administration has locked in some bad provisions in that in the NAFTA renegotiation. We need to make sure that Congress holds the administration accountable, and not only is it accountable, but improving. This is about perfecting, right? Yep. Or at least making it as best as possible. As I've said to a few people today, we may have gotten 2 out of 10 what we need, but let's get to 6, let's get to 7, and let's get to 10 out of 10 of what we need, so American workers and their families can have the surety that Congress and the president, no matter who that president is going to ensure that protect their jobs first and foremost.
Roy, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the thoughts. Thanks so much.
No, thank you so much, Rick.
Good stuff. Again, I guess it really does come back to the very simple thing of calling your member of Congress early, calling them often, sharing your thoughts. And I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Am I off base? Is this bit of so-called support for Donald Trump a bridge too far? Or do we really need these tariffs? I'd love to hear it. rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. The reason I think the China situation is so important, and I'm thankful to Roy for coming on and sharing some of his thoughts. The reason I think the China situation is so important is, look, just in the last couple of decades, we've lost 60,000 factories. I mean, let that sink in for a minute. 60,000 factories of more than 500 workers. That's not to mention all of the little feeder factories that went in to feed those. You think about, you know, the giant ones that have gone. And this has all been part of the Chinese plan. Look, the Chinese are very smart. They didn't want to build the spoke for the wheel. They wanted to build the whole damn wheel. And not only do they want to build the wheel, they want to build the car that the wheel goes on. And you look at the fact that they've got this China 2025 plan where they want to take over the emerging industries. They don't want to be low-level factory, low-level production. They don't want to, you know, do the plastics and the widgets and the whatnots anymore. They want the pharmaceutical industry. It's no longer about auto parts. It's no longer about Tupperware, toys or bikes or anything. They want pharmaceuticals. They want an automotive industry that is going to crush what we have left. They want the aerospace industry. They want semiconductors. They want IT. They want robotics. They want the next generation. What we were told, go to school, get your education. Don't be that grunt factory worker. Be better than that. They want that next generation of jobs that were supposed to be the next middle class jobs here in this country. And their policy moving them in that direction. They're investing heavily, heavily in those industries, just as they've invested heavily in taking over the industries that they've targeted stealing from us. And the thing that's incredible to me is that American CEOs, who were supposed to be smart people, they allowed it to happen and did it gleefully along with the rest of the wealth class, which leads me to the logical conclusion that they don't really care about this country. They care about profit. They care about themselves. They care about their pocket. They don't care about American workers. They don't care about communities. They don't care about us. That blatantly clear. And this is one of those moments where, policy-wise, both parties had better get their heads out of the sand, because we're already in a trade war. You know, I love when people would say, you want a trade war. Hello, we've been in a trade war for the last 20 years. The only problem is we have been getting our butts kicked because we weren't fighting back. We weren't even using the tools available to us. And I go back to the tire suit that the steel workers brought against the Chinese, that our government didn't even really get involved in. It had to be the union. And the company didn't want the union to fight it because they wanted the cheap labor. It was all about the cheap labor. You know, understand, and I've been saying this for a while, cheap labor is heroin to a CEO. It's heroin to the investor class, because what that means, it means more for them. It means less for you, but it means more for them. And country and flag and all of that stuff mean absolutely nothing. So ultimately, what has to happen is we all have to come around to the idea that the neoliberal trade regime has to be killed. And we need a new direction. I would love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me, do we need tariffs? Should we go to a value-added tax? Something we should be talking about in the near future. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you.